Today we have, we're really super pleased that Congressman John Faso took a moment out of his busy schedule to come and talk with us. Hi, John.
Thanks, Holly. Great to be with you and Justin and your listeners today.
How's your summer going?
It feels like summer today,
although
the calendar tells us it's fall. I think this may be one of the last days where we really feel that summer-like warmth.
It's beautiful outside, it's beautiful, but we're glad you're in here in the studio with us. So let's get right to it, John. There's a lot of things going on. Obviously, you're in a heated race this was your freshman term. Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, it's really been, it's quite an honor to serve, and I've very much enjoyed it. There are a lot of issues that we're dealing with. We're in a very polarized political environment in the country, and I've tried to turn down the polarization as much as I can.
Well, you are in a very tight race right now for New York's 19th Congressional District, and your opponent is Antonio Delgado, and there have been some polls out. Do you pay attention to polls, or you just keep on trucking and doing what your campaign wants you to do and what you feel is necessary to win? Or are you a poll guy? Do you watch numbers?
I don't really pay that much attention to polls. Most of the public polls that are out there show it's a close race, and I believe that it is. And so I think the only poll, as we say, Justin, that matters is on Election Day.
And the North Pole during Christmas.
That's true.
Very important poll.
That is a very important poll.
Yeah.
We like to keep it light here, John Faso. Just saying.
Well, you know, it is a very close race. We don't even need to say that. Since you don't care, we're not going to say the numbers. But it's very close.
Well, what do you feel are some of your major issues, John? I know there's been some TV ads. Let's talk about the TV ads right off the get-go.
The major issue that I see in our district is we have high taxes in upstate New York, and we have declining population. Every county among the 11 in our congressional district has lost population over the last 10 years.
It's the
weather. You're seeing this,
right?
You're seeing this in upstate New York generally. But I think when I talk to businesses and farmers, they're concerned about the workforce. And so getting the right skill set for employers is really important. Agriculture is really pressed hard because we have to fix the migrant worker issue and the immigration issue generally, and I've been in the forefront on that. And of course, healthcare is an issue for everyone because people are concerned about the cost and availability.
Right.
The main things that people that I've spoken to regarding having you on the show. You can't help if you're at home between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. and you're trying to watch your Modern Family or you're trying to watch Judge Judy. Every 2 seconds, there's an ad. And there's one from Republicans and there's one from Democrats. And Delgado's is attacking you. And yours seems to be focused on his lyrics from when he was a rapper. Do you want to talk about the ads? And
you can talk about anything you want, but those the critique of his musical career are not my ads.
Right.
Those are ads that are done independent of my campaign. What I've focused on...
And that's important to know, too.
Yeah,
right.
And this distinction is often lost because the average person out there really doesn't understand or pay attention to who's paying for what.
Right.
So I'm happy to talk about any of these issues.
And that's something good to know. So when they're coming out with these ads, they don't have to give you the final approval on. They put the ads out there.
Not even final, Justin. Not even beginning.
See, that's very important because a lot of people see something and they instantly say, "Aha! I can't believe
you
put that out there."
You are by law precluded from having any coordination or participation with outside independent groups. And this, by the way, I would mention, was a reform of the federal election law. So whenever I always enjoy hearing people with new proposals to, quote unquote, reform this system. Well, the system that we have today is the one that the reformers got what they wanted. They excluded parties from a lot of the direct involvement with candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And they created this system whereby you have these independent groups that raise and spend money that are separate, totally separate from candidates.
Right. Which is why you don't hear this message is approved by blah, 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 or I approve this message. I'm so-and-so. So if you don't hear that, then that candidate has nothing
not
to do
candidate ad
with that ad.
That.
So
that's important. Let's get to substantive questions, though.
Yeah.
Sure. Holly, go ahead.
Right. Well, so let's address the healthcare issue. I know that's been a hot topic, and there was an ad that was put out. I don't know who paid for it, but that says let's talk about the age tax, right? Age tax on seniors.
That is a fake notion. There is no such thing as an age tax. Mm-hmm. In fact, the concept of charging a 50 to 64 year old more is something that was embedded in the Affordable Care Act. Now, this is standard actuarial practice, actually. But let's step back a second. Who are we talking about in this? We're not talking about Medicare. We're not talking about Medicaid. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about anyone that is in a group or a large group employer-based plan. We're talking about the individual health insurance market, which is about 7% of the insureds. And the way insurers traditionally price those policies, they price them according to actuarial risk. And just like 20-year-old males pay more for car insurance than 50-year-old males or 50-year-old women, similarly, a 60-year-old person, male or female, will pay more in the individual market for health insurance than a 25-year-old male or female, because actuarially, the older person is going to use more health insurance. And that concept is one of longstanding, and it was in the ACA. It was in the bill that I voted for in the House. But here's the rub. The New York State and Vermont are the only two states in the nation which by law preclude a health insurer from charging someone older in the individual market more than someone who is younger. So the argument that there's an age tax in New York State, so-called, is absolutely false. And in fact, an independent fact checker labeled the accusation about the so-called age tax as being a false and misleading ad.
Okay. We have a call.
Go ahead.
I was thinking, I think people are calling it the wrong thing. I think they are realizing what they don't want is older folks to have to pay more for health care. And they're calling it an age tax, and it's simply wrong wording.
Well, it's
because
not,
it's age banding, correct?
It's not for Medicare. Again, it is the individual health insurance market, which is about 7% of insureds, and the individual market is the place where there has been the most volatility, both in price and in access. And I think one of the fundamental flaws of the Affordable Care Act, instead of going after the issue of affordability and access for the 40 million Americans that didn't have health insurance, they changed the market for 200 plus million Americans who did have health insurance. And that is where, you know, I've had many people say to me, the ACA was good for them. They were able to either get in the Medicaid expansion or they were able to utilize one of the bronze or silver plans. However, I've had just as many people, if not more, tell me that their health insurance has just spiked tremendously. And what good is insurance if you have an $8,000 deductible and you're making $40,000 a year?
Right.
It's pretty hard to really use that insurance. So this is one of the issues that I think I hope if I'm reelected, we can address. I'm part of a thing called the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus, and we've actually put forth proposals that centrist Democrats and Republicans actually support on reforming the insurance markets. So I'm hopeful that we can get something like that done next year.
I will say, in doing my research, there's over 400 folks. You're ranked number 18 as one of the most bipartisan,
right?
Out of 400 plus, so
435. I ranked number 18.
Yes.
So when I introduce a bill, I will rarely introduce a bill unless I have a Democratic co-sponsor, either leading it or being part of it, because I think this is one of the fundamental problems in our country today. The left tends to listen and read the things they already agree with, mm-hmm. and the right tends to listen and watch and read the things they already agree with, and it becomes a self-confirming cycle, and people don't...
There's no middle ground, right?
And they don't
meeting
see
in the, middle.
The middle ground. Mm-hmm. And what is the media, if you're on cable news or you're on the radio, one of the talk radio programs, what sells? What do you have to do if you're a
controversy?
Yeah. You've got to get eyeballs on your screen, sure, or listeners, okay? Yeah. And how do you do that? You sell controversy. You don't cover things that show compromise and coordination. Right. You show things that show polarization.
Right.
And so I firmly believe that we should act in a more bipartisan fashion, and that's what I've done consciously since I've gone to Congress.
Yeah, very good.
Do we have a call, or do we don't have a call?
We had a question that came in, which is, how do you feel about the ads that the National Republican groups are running on your behalf, not the ones that you are paying for? Vern from Hudson.
Well, they're provocative ads that go after Delgado's rap career. There's no doubt about it. But the words that he authored in those lyrics are provocative as well. And so I think, again, this is something that he should explain what he means and whether he still subscribes to the political views that he authored in those words. And it doesn't matter if it's rap music or if it's folk music or if it's poetry or if it's an opera libretto, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little go on with Antonio Delgado because, after all, he has no record in this district. He literally just moved into this district in March or April of 2017, bought a house, a week later signed up to run for Congress. He's never lived or worked in this district in his entire adult life, or his entire life. He grew up in Schenectady, which is not in the district, but he only recently came here. So it is just like my record and my words and my votes are subject to critique and criticism. The bare record we have of his involvement in public affairs are the lyrics that he authored, which express some very controversial views.
Okay, very good.
The other ad that's paramount is the young mom who was a cancer survivor. She came to you, and this is the ad that we see all over the place,
right,
and she asked you to promise her that she wasn't going to lose her health insurance due to pre-existing conditions, and there was the promise made, and she ended up losing based on a vote that you had. Do you want to clear anything up for people that see these ads that don't know anything about you, that don't know anything about the story? What are we missing that's not being shown in the ad?
Well, what you're missing is right in fact, in your question. The person in question was part of a group of about 300 people that were standing on my lawn in a January 2017, and she said, related to me, and I knew of this young lady because she grew up in our community. And she related that she had a medical condition that was quite serious, and I certainly sympathize with that. And I said to her, she said, promise me you're not going to take away the protections for pre-existing conditions or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, I do promise. And indeed, the bill we voted on supports and protects people with pre-existing conditions. But the irony in this entire discussion is that she is not in the private insurance market. She's on Medicaid, and I know that because she told me she is on Medicaid. So if you're on Medicaid, there is no question as to eligibility based on your medical condition. It's strictly based on income. And so not only is the ad false, and I blame Delgado and Nancy Pelosi for this, it is false to suggest that the bill we voted on doesn't cover people with pre-existing condition, because it does. But it's ironic that they're using as an example someone who this doesn't even apply to because she's on Medicaid.
I was reading up on this, and it does cover pre-existing conditions, but it does put you into a separate pool where it's much higher of a cost.
That's an allegation, but that allegation is false as well.
Okay.
Again, here you have to discern, well, what are we talking about? What kind of insurance pool are you in? This issue doesn't even come up if the question is Medicare, Medicaid, or if you have employer-provided health insurance. And mind you, 165 to 170 million Americans have employer-provided health insurance. So this question doesn't even arise if you're in those categories. It only might potentially arise if you are in the individual insurance market. So there's a waiver provision that was in our bill that would apply in the individual insurance market in the small instance where someone has a pre-existing condition and they didn't maintain their continuous coverage. So if you can just conceptualize this in another context, the property and casualty context, if the tree falls on your house and you canceled your homeowner's insurance a month before, would you be able to go to the insurance company and say, oh, by the way, cover me now? I think we all know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. So the question was, how do you get people to, in the individual market, how do you get people to maintain their coverage? And if they don't maintain their coverage, should they be able to get insurance with a pre-existing condition? Our answer is yes, even in that category, they should be able to get it. And so there's a limited waiver situation that a governor could apply for. Frankly, it's a little getting a lot in the weeds here. I don't think under New York law, a New York governor would be able to apply for it, even if he or she wanted to. So the fact is that our bill protected people with pre-existing conditions. The example they, and this is Delgado and Pelosi, who are falsely accusing me of not doing so. And the example they use is a person who isn't even affected by this argument.
Right.
Because she's on Medicaid.
Now, speak a little bit, John, if you will, about what Delgado is in favor of, and Schumer and Gillibrand also, the single-payer health care.
Yeah,
speak to that issue.
So here's one of the things. The argument is single-payer. Have the government do it. It'll, like Nirvana, it will solve all these problems. Couple of things I would say. We have an example of a single-payer system in the United States. It is called the Veterans Administration.
Mm.
The Veterans Administration has had well-publicized issues and difficulties, but that is a closed-loop, single-payer system. It is does not necessarily bring medical perfection. Also, look at the countries around the world that do have a universal or single-payer government-run system, and some of them have modifications of it, Germany, for instance. In every single instance, those nations have annual debates as to how much money can we afford to spend and what should we cover. In fact, you remember in the United Kingdom, in England, there was the argument last year about the young boy. Who the government, National Health Service, said, we're not going to give you this operation.
And they wouldn't let him leave.
And they wouldn't let him leave
and
the
he
country
died.
To get it. And he died. Okay.
Government-run health care.
But this is an example which, as Americans, we would never tolerate. So here's what I do think the proposal that Bernie Sanders and others and a lot of the Democrats are now backing, and I believe my opponent, although he's all over the lot on this, he actually supports it. If you go to a single-payer, government-run healthcare system, that means you abolish, by law, employer-provided health insurance. So if you have an employer who gives you health insurance now, you won't have it. You have to go into a government plan.
Wow.
Second, you will abolish the existing Medicare system. And good, you know, solid estimates say that it would require $32 trillion in cost over 10 years, and which would require a doubling of the income tax. So, you know, anyone that's, look, I agree the current system needs fixing, and I support that. And I'm working as a part of the Problem Solvers. I encourage anyone to go to the Problem Solvers website, and you can see some of the proposals we've made.
Is it a bipartisan group,
John? And it's bipartisan. You can't join unless you bring someone from the opposite party with you.
Huh?
There are 25 Dems and 25 Republicans. And here's one of the things that I think a lot of folks out there don't get, because it doesn't really get through the kind of national media noise, and that is that there is, I believe, a centrist majority in the House made up of Democrats and Republicans who actually want to solve things like immigration and health care. And, you know, we actually had a lot of cooperation this last year on veterans issues, on opioids. We just passed a big bill.
Yeah,
on
we want
opioids.
To talk about the opioid
and
thing.
So there actually is more cooperation than you would think. Now, there are clearly some differences philosophically, but you know, all is not lost here.
That's good news to hear.
Yeah. Speaking of the opioid
right.
bill that you want to talk about, on October 3rd, it was published in the Daily Star that a massive bill to combat the opioid crisis was passed by the Senate on Wednesday, and it will be sent to the White House for final approval. And it was done by a vote of 98-1. And it's called the STOP Act.
Yep.
And STOP stands for the Synthetics Trafficking and Overdose Protection Act. And it's co-sponsored in the House. House by You. Yep. And it's intended to crack down on shipments of highly dangerous opioids such as fentanyl from China and Mexico. You want to talk a little bit more about that and why that was so important to you?
This was incorporated in the big bill that passed the Senate and House. And I'm really pleased at that. We have literally the amount of fentanyl in a grain of the size of a grain of rice is enough to kill 20 or 25 people. And so how does the fentanyl get into the United States, this synthetic toxic fentanyl? Because fentanyl is used by anesthesiologists for medical reasons. But how does the bad stuff get into the United States? Most of it comes into the United States through the United States Postal Service. It's kind of shocking. And when I got down to Washington, I didn't realize this before I got elected. But once I did and people started talking to me about this, I started looking at it. And what we had to do was crack down on this. I became the lead sponsor of a bill in the House with 275 co-sponsors. It was sponsored by Senator Portman, who did great work on this in the Senate from Ohio. And this bill says, in essence, the Postal Service has to follow the rules that the UPS and FedEx have to follow. So when they accept a shipment from outside the United States into the United States, that shipment, they have to have verifiable information as to who's sending it and what's in it. And they electronically have to send that information to the Customs Service, because the Customs Service is otherwise left with trying to find a needle in the haystack. So the Customs Service, with this computerized information, can, using analytical techniques, they can target and pinpoint the suspicious senders to try to stop this. In fact, if you go to some of these websites in China that are selling fentanyl on the internet, they say preferred method of shipping, U.S. Postal Service. So
right across the street. Don't do that, Justin. Don't go to those websites.
Don't worry.
Is that the dark web?
My bill was incorporated in the much larger bill that the president is going to sign, I think, the third week of October. And it's an example, 99-1 in the Senate and overwhelmingly passed in the House.
Bipartisan
and another
support.
Example of there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans on the need to address this opioid crisis.
And what a great piece of legislation that you think we should be touting about and gets very little attention. But all of us have been impacted by someone who's died of an overdose
Every
in this community, in this congressional district, for sure. So that's a huge piece of news. So it doesn't impact citizens' mail, correct? It's just mail coming into the country.
No, but mail that someone might be sending you from outside of the country, they're gonna if you're sending a package,
it's gonna be scrutinized.
You're gonna have more scrutiny to it.
Well, that's a good thing.
Other plans in that package include new non-addictive painkillers. So does that mean they're gonna redo the chemistry of these pain pills to make them less addictive?
Well, I think there's much research going on in development of alternative to opioids for pain relief, because some people do suffer from chronic pain, and that was the whole reason why the opioid prescriptions were developed to begin with.
We do have other hot button issues.
I think we have a question. Oh, I don't know what it's going to be, but it was called in earlier. Okay. It's about healthcare, is that right? Okay, so I'm going to play. Did it work? Double click? Oh, there it goes.
Yes, hi there. I'm going to record a message when Tanner and Weaver interview Representative John Faso at 2 o'clock today, Wednesday. My name is Joy Dreyer. I'm a constituent, and I am most curious about his plans to cover his constituents for health care. I understand that he was a deciding vote in committee allowing Trump's health care bill to get out of committee, and that would in fact charge people with pre-existing conditions significantly more. I've also read that he's also accepted about $100,000 in campaign contributions from the health care industry. I'd like him to address both those issues and also talk about what his plans are to cover people in his district for pre-existing conditions and keeping our healthcare costs low. Please be very specific what his plans are. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that question, caller. Yes, go ahead, John.
Thanks for the question. We've already addressed a number of these issues here. Our bill did protect people with pre-existing conditions. And one of the things that I think is important is to take a look at what we've proposed from the problem solvers, because the GOP plan that passed the House did not get considered in the Senate. And what we've got to do is pursue incremental reforms, I believe, into the system. So, for instance, one of the things that we'd like to do to lower premiums and deductibles for people would be to create something called a reinsurance model so that, and this has already been established in a couple of states, but at the federal and state level, we could create a reinsurance fund that would basically pay the costs for very high-cost individuals. So the health plan would cover you up to a certain level, say $75,000 worth of expense. But if it goes beyond that, then the reinsurance kicks in to cover that cost. What that does is it gives the health plan predictability as to what its extended liability is. Remember, when they're estimating what the rate should be, they're basically it's not necessarily a crapshoot, but it's an estimate based upon experience and knowledge as to the pool of people that they're covering. The estimate is often thrown off when you have very, very high cost individuals right. in the system. So what we're trying to do is lower premiums and deductibles for people broadly. And if we had this reinsurance model, which would be paid for by federal and state taxpayers, okay. it would shield those costs, those excessive costs, from the pricing of premiums and deductibles for everyone else. And why would this be significant? Because about 70% of overall healthcare costs are incurred by about 10% of the people. And again, just simply saying, "Oh, I have a bronze plan," and if you have a $8,000 deductible, that's not necessarily affordable. Other things I'd like to see done would benefit small businesses, especially those small businesses that are providing health insurance. One of the things the Problem Solvers has proposed is to raise the employer mandate number from 50 employees to 500. You would be amazed. I just met with an employer in Oneonta yesterday. You would be amazed the number of employers that have told me they have reduced their payroll below 50 so that they don't have to comply with the employer mandate, which greatly raises their costs. Most of the businesses in our district are under 500 employees.
Sure.
There are a few more than that, but not too many. And if we could raise that employer mandate as the moderate Dems and Republicans have proposed, then I think that would go a long way towards alleviating some of the concern that businesses have. And I hear this all the time about the annual steep increases in healthcare costs.
Very good.
So those are some of the things. The lady made this, again, they're attacking me on so-called insurance contributions. What they're doing is they're disingenuously combining property and casualty insurance, life insurance, health insurance, all sorts of insurance groups and people that work for insurance company. They're combining it all together. This is not a particularly significant amount of money, number one. But number two, it's very deceptive the way they bundle that all together. And I think, frankly, they're doing it over a number of campaigns. I certainly don't know where they get that number from, and I haven't bothered to research it because it's another fake kind of incendiary charge. But it's intended to get people to think, oh, there's something odious about this. Important to keep in mind, who were the major promoters of the Affordable Care Act in the when it was passed in the Congress? The health insurance industry.
Right.
They wrote most of the Affordable Care Act. So keep that in mind when you're evaluating some of these charges.
Absolutely.
That's another call, but before we get to that,
it's someone that wants to donate.
Yes,
that'd be nice.
We'll get back to that.
Yes.
Thank you for keeping us on track. I did watch your two town hall style meetings that you had. They aired on New York Now up at the Capitol.
One was on Channel 17,
right?
WMHT.
Yes.
Yep.
And you did say that in 2000. Hey, I do my research, and he's an important person.
It's I watched it too,
Joe Schmo. you said in 2034, Social Security will only be able to pay 79% of our total benefit. And you had the idea, you were saying during that town hall meeting, you wanted to form a bipartisan group that takes this out of politics and makes it so that we can come up with solutions. Where are you on that? Have you started that ball rolling?
I've co-sponsored legislation to do that. There hasn't been a lot of movement on it because no one right now wants to touch this, including the administration. But here's what the problem is. The problem is 2034 is only 16 years from now. And the Social Security trustees, who are nonpartisan folks, say that, as you mentioned, Justin, the system can only pay 79% of the promised benefits in 2034. Now, what's significant about 2034? Well, 2034 is 50 years from 1984. And I'm not making an Orwellian comment here.
Okay.
I'm simply saying that was when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill came up with a bipartisan solution based upon a commission that they had appointed, led by then Alan Greenspan. And the Greenspan Commission got a lot of good, smart minds together, and they came up with a plan that would secure the financing of the Social Security system for 50 years. And when they did this in 1984, everyone said, yeah, 50 years, that's a long way away. We won't have to worry about it for a while. Well,
here we are.
16 years from now, it's right around the corner. So the longer we delay in trying to fix this problem, the worse, the harder it'll be. So I tell people, if you're over 50, you really don't have anything to, I think, worry about. It's the people under 50, that many of whom are are questioning whether the system will be there for them.
Right.
And what we have to do in order to keep that promise is we've got to reform it so we make sure it's there not only for the people who are on it and are soon going to be on it, but for the people who are under 50, so that they have an assurance that their investment in Social Security will bring them something meaningful when they retire.
Right.
But, you know, Social Security was never meant to be the sole source of income, so it's very important. And one of the things that I have supported in Congress is enhancing the ability of people to save for their retirement. And I really encourage young people, when they go to work for an employer that has a deferred comp plan or a 401k, to get in it. Because those dollars you save now will pay dividends later.
Absolutely. Now, John, if we can, let's talk a bit about you were just involved in a bill that passed or is in the works regarding farming and the dairy industry and the treaties with the Canadians. Why don't you touch on that briefly? Because in the district, I know in Columbia County, farming is, and I'm assuming it's district-wide, and I know you spend a lot of time in the farming community, so
I do.
We appreciate support.
We have a big agriculture district. Dairy is really in trouble. And the main reason dairy is in trouble is because we have a couple of things going on. Consumption has gone down about 20% in the last 25 years, and the price that dairy farmers are receiving is actually about the same as they were getting in 1982.
Oh, is it 82 now? Oh, good.
And keep in mind, how many of us could live on what we were making in 1982?
Right.
And that's indeed what dairy farmers are going through now. So a number of things, we're trying to address this in the farm bill to give a little more certainty and insurance certainty for farmers, dairy farmers. But the other thing that just happened, the administration just concluded a trade agreement with Canada. And the Canadians have long had a very, very negative and discriminatory policy towards U.S. dairy products. They're very protectionist when it comes to their own industry. And about 2.5 years ago, they instituted something called Class 7 milk, which deals with something called ultra-filtered milk, which is used in the production primarily of cheese. And there were many New York dairy producers that were shipping ultra-filtered milk into Canada. The Canadians basically shut this down. And then not only did they shut it down, they started dumping milk on the world market, which further depressed the price. So the Trump administration, I think, should be applauded for getting some of these changes in our agreement with Canada. They also had a peculiar thing. When I was up in Canada dealing with this issue and talking to the Canadians as part of an agriculture delegation, I learned that if you're a wheat farmer in North Dakota and you ship your wheat to a grain elevator in Canada, no matter what the quality of the wheat is, the Canadians will only classify it as fit for animal consumption.
Really?
Yeah. So the administration got the Canadians to drop this discriminatory trade practice as well for our wheat farmers. And also, if you're selling wine, you can now buy American wine on the shelves of stores in British Columbia, where British Columbia said you couldn't sell any American wine. So very discriminatory agricultural practices. And the administration made some concessions on some of the things that they were asking for, which, frankly, I don't think ever made any sense. So bottom line is that we have a long way to go. But I encourage people to drink milk. Remember, here's a real misnomer. We have 1% milk. We have 2% milk. And then you have whole milk. Well, you know what percent whole milk is? It's 3.5% milk. So people right. have this
it's not
100%
assumption. Milk.
People have this assumption that, well, whole milk is just filled with fats and things. We're trying also to get whole milk back into the school lunch program, which is really important because kids need whole milk. Skim milk and 1% and 2% milk aren't as good for kids as whole milk.
And you have already successfully advocated for the inclusion of low-fat chocolate milk in the school lunch program.
Right, exactly. And Sonny Perdue, the agriculture secretary, was able to do that administratively. But to get whole milk into the school lunch program, we actually have to pass a law, which seems crazy, but we do.
So you can do low fat, but you can't do whole milk.
Yeah.
Wow, there's so many like weird. How do you keep up with everything?
How do you
keep up with everything and all the little regulations and the loopholes and you can do this and you can't do that? Does it take a lot of studying or do you just have it all up there? Have you memorized everything?
No, Justin, I haven't. Holly may have memorized all the fees on motor vehicles and firearms permits. I have spent a lot of time through my career studying these issues. So one of the advantages I had going down to Congress in 2017 was that I did have the experience at the state level. And Albany is just a microcosm of what goes on at the national level, but there are a heck of a lot more issues that you have to deal with. So
it is a lot more to it, isn't it?
It's really astonishing. I had the opportunity to visit South Korea earlier this year to talk to the Koreans about the whole issue of North Korea and nuclearization on the peninsula, etc. And that was a fascinating experience as well. So this job does afford you the opportunity to really delve into things that you otherwise wouldn't have the ability to do. And I'm doing it on behalf of our country and our constituents.
All of the constituents. Why do you do this job, John? What do you enjoy about it? I mean, you mentioned earlier in the program, you know, you had protesters on your lawn at one point. So why do you do what you do?
And I'm told that every Friday there's something that goes on in Kinderhook. They're in front of your they're protesting a Freaky Friday or Fasto Friday or something like
Freaky
that.
Freaky Friday.
Every Friday they're out in front of your...
That's fine. I mean, it's First Amendment. The vast majority of people are actually courteous. And even if they're feeling strongly about an issue, they are... have a respectful conversation. Unfortunately, there are some that are literally, can't be reasoned with. But at the same time, it just goes with the territory.
A couple more hot button issues. You did say you've been quoted saying that you don't expect the law to change regarding women having the right to abortions, but that you are personally pro-life. And you were quoted at one point saying that Roe v. Wade was a black mark on the country. Just a couple of days ago, Senator Mazie Hirono, a Democrat from Hawaii, told ABC News chief White House correspondent Jonathan Carl on This Week Sunday that she doubts the court will actually overturn Roe v. Wade, but even if they don't, they will nullify it, pretty much. Do you agree with those statements? Do you feel that the right to abortion is going to be taken away due to Kavanaugh filling that last Supreme Court justice seat?
Well, I don't, number one, because I think that the principle of stare decisis, meaning respect for earlier precedent, is one that's a strong one in the court, particularly among some of the conservative justices as well. So I would be hesitant to speculate on it because you never know what case actually comes before them. But I do think that the episode of the Kavanaugh nomination was pretty sad. And while everyone who makes an allegation of sexual harassment, that should be treated seriously and respectfully, we also have a countervailing interest in this country, which is due process and the rule of law. And you're innocent until proven guilty. And I really was concerned about the Senate Democrats not providing this information when they received it to the FBI, which could have looked at it and done made that part of their background examination. But even once the background examination was completed and they found no corroboration, and some of these allegations, like this woman who alleged gang rapes and things like that, it's astonishingly reckless and outrageous, without any proof whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like a new McCarthyism, if you will. We grew up hearing about what Joe McCarthy did, accusing people of being sympathizers to communism and to the Soviet Union without having proof. And under our system, you cannot, justice, Lady Justice, she has holding a scale of justice in her hand, and on the other hand, she's holding a sword.
But what is she?
She's blindfolded. And she's blindfolded because our system of justice is intended to make sure that the adjudicator is blind to the political viewpoint of the person who's in front of them. That is something that regardless of if you're on the left or the right, that is something that we have to cherish and uphold in our country. And I think some on the left were falling down the slippery slope of basically, I don't like you because you're a conservative, and therefore I'm going to try to destroy you and damage irreparably your reputation because we want to prove a political point. That is a bad thing for our country.
Okay, so immigration. You talked about co-sponsoring a bill to allow for legalized status of immigrants who came here before age 16, as long as they haven't committed crimes. Do you still feel that way? And there a bill?
I voted for a bill in the House. It failed because none of the Democrats would vote for it, and a lot of the real conservatives in the House got cold feet. But here's what we should do. We have to have operational security of the border. There were 38,000 people that came across the border illegally in June. About 8,000 or 10,000 of those were unaccompanied minors. So we really have a problem there. I think everyone recognizes this. And this problem didn't start with Trump. It's been going on for 25 years. So we need to get operational control of the border. So we need better border security. And in some limited instances, that means you build structure or barrier or you use technology. Because the Border Patrol needs it in certain areas. Other areas, it would be completely impractical and wouldn't make any sense. But we also need to do things like fix the DACA problem. That's what you alluded to. Mm-hmm. The people who were brought here as children through no fault of their own, their parents may have violated the law, but they never did.
Right.
So people who say on the right that, oh, that's amnesty, well, they're ignoring the fact that you only get an amnesty if you violated a law.
Right.
Those folks didn't violate a law.
Right.
So now they're young people here in the United States. They really know no other country than the United States. So it would make no sense for us, particularly in a time when we have more open jobs than we have unemployed people in the country. It would make no sense to say, oh, we should deport these people or leave them still in this kind of state of legal limbo. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make sense. So we should, so long as they haven't violated a law themselves and their record is clean, they should be given a document which says that they are permitted to stay in the country. And they can eventually, within a few years, apply for a green card and then begin a process where they could become a citizen. That's what happens when you get a green card. They shouldn't get online ahead of people who came here and did it all the legal way. Mm-hmm. But they should have an opportunity to make themselves right with the law because of the peculiar circumstances with which they were brought into the country. You know, I go to naturalization ceremonies in our district, down in Ulster County and other places, and it's one of the best. It's one of the best things.
It is. They're awesome.
People getting sworn in. They're so excited. They and their families are so excited, so proud to be Americans. They also know more about our laws and our civic requirements than do natural-born American citizens often. It's a great thing. So we should continue to be a country where people aspire and want to come here. It improves our country, but we should make sure we have a legal process where our country controls its borders and we have an orderly process, and also to deal with this ag labor issue, which I'm also out in favor on.
Right. Is that something you think will happen, John, eventually?
I do. I think actually that would be easier for us to do. And I hope in the next Congress, if I'm there, that we are able to get this done. And it would be kind of a confidence-building measure for the Congress as a whole on dealing with immigration as a whole.
Right. Great.
Now that we're getting close to almost being done...
Yeah, I don't know what your time frame is, John. Go ahead.
I know that you have to go.
I know I do, but...
but is there more stuff you want to talk about? Well, we're getting down to it, but they did tell us we could go over for you because you're special. So you dictate the schedule. One or two more questions.
I was going to ask... Just point blank, anybody that's listening right now, why should they vote for you specifically over Antonio Delgado? Excuse me, I said his name wrong.
Because I have a record in this district for 35 years. I've lived and worked here, raised our family here. I know the district. Number two, in my 18 months in Congress, I've operated in a bipartisan fashion. I think that's what most people want us to do, to find solutions to problems, not simply go down there and say, well, I'm just going to oppose everything that one side wants or support everything that the other side wants. Not go down there and just be an automatic vote one way or the other. Use your common sense and your discretion. And number three, I mean, I have proposed things that would actually help our upstate economy in using my vehicle or my platform as a member of Congress, like reforming the notorious scaffold law in New York State, where on any federally funded project, this would save enormous amounts of money for the taxpayers. We're the only state in the nation with this crazy law. It doesn't help workers. All it does is help a small group of trial lawyers. You hear them, the ads on TV and radio. Hurt in a construction accident? New York has special laws to help you. That's what this is all about. And so we should go to a comparative negligence standard, which is what 49 states do, not strict liability as New York does. The other thing is I want to continue to work on things like issues like opioids and on veterans and Lyme disease. These are things that I'm deeply involved in already, and I would want to continue.
That's awesome.
My brother just texted me, Donnie Weaver, and he said, "You got my vote, Faso."
Oh, so very just nice.
Put that on the air. Hey, that's
pretty
good.
Thanks, Donnie. Very good. Let's talk briefly then about veterans issues. John, you mentioned it when we talked about the single payer, but you know what? John does come every month. We have an honor vet committee and a ceremony where we honor deceased veterans in Columbia County, and I think we're not the only county in the district to do that. But what do you see as can be fixed with veterans? What can we do?
Well, we've actually enacted significant measures, again, on a bipartisan basis, signed by President Trump, Democrats and Republicans. I mean, it, again, doesn't get any coverage. But we've fixed the backlog. We've created a different process for fixing the backlog of almost 500,000 disability cases. So now there's a more streamlined process that veterans can choose. I had a veteran, for instance, that had a 17-year pending disability application.
Oh, my God.
And we solved that for him in a few months. We've also transitioning the Veterans Choice Program to a new system starting in mid-2019, which will allow veterans to go to a local medical provider without having to jump through all the different hoops that they currently have to do. That will, I think, afford them more flexible and better access to health care that they needed in their communities. Third, we've embraced some very large operational changes at the VA, allowing dismissal of employees that are negligent or not performing their duties, and also bringing new capital dollars to improve the facilities at the VA. Our veterans served our country. We have an obligation to make sure that they are protected and that they're getting good health care and in their retirement and old age that we're protecting them as a reference.
Absolutely.
Now, I just wanted to say one other thing, and that is I'm going out, and this is why I've got to leave, because I've got to do some preparation tonight to a remembrance in Schoharie of the 20 people who
were lost.
That was a terrible accident in our district.
Yeah,
most of the people were actually residents of Montgomery County in the
Amsterdam
area.
Yeah,
we have part of Montgomery County in our district, but it was a terrible and shocking situation. And our hearts bleed for those that were lost and for their families that were left behind.
Horrible.
There's one family that I saw left a four-year-old daughter and I think a 15-month-old daughter.
One really
family
tragic
lost four sisters.
Very.
So it's one of those things. It makes you, it reminds us again how precious and fragile life is.
What's really important.
Some of the kind of day-to-day things that we go through in our lives mm-hmm. are really irrelevant when you compare that mm-hmm. to the need for us to love and nurture our families and
friends.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, yep. I'm sure they'll appreciate you being there, and we do send our prayers, and how awful. It'll be interesting to hear what comes out of the whole investigation of what happened. Because
it will be. You as a motor vehicle official.
Yeah, well, first when it came out that he didn't have the right license, it turned out he did have a commercial driver license, but most likely did not have the passenger endorsement, which is attestable to be carrying that many passengers. So if he didn't have that on his license, and those...
And I think we also have to really take a hard look at the safety protocols for vehicles like this.
That are stretched,
modified. I don't, for instance,
modified.
Think that these bank seating arrangements within a vehicle are at all safe. And I think we need to revisit that.
You hear about plane crashes where people survive, and this
yeah.
was a vehicle.
Well, I guess seatbelts were not required for that back part of the limo, which is for the front.
Even if you were sitting with a seatbelt in that bank style, it probably would not have protected
right.
in that kind of crash.
Just horrible. Well, very, very tragic. Well, we thank you, John Fasso, for your
thank
time.
Thank you, John
Thanks,
Fasso.
Justin,
very
thank
much.
Good luck with the election.
Absolutely.
You got my brother's vote.
Yeah, you too, Holly.
Thank you,
yeah.
Congressman.
Oh, yeah.
Thank
Good luck,
you.
Holly.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate your time and coming on. And
running unopposed, I should only wish.
And coming on, spending some time and clarifying something. So that was very good. And
thank you, Congressman John Fasso.